Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, incredibly surprising and impressive. Well, Manton, I am happy to report that the notes that I was so quick to blame Apple for losing, they were right there all along on my IMAP account, my IMAP server. You were right. I think you suggested this in the last show that Notes supports like IMAP. I guess I knew this because I was using it, but you know, it was just one of those things. Actually, I think from way back when, the way it appears to you as a user is basically, do you want to use your email account for Notes? And I'm like, ah, I guess so. I don't know. And then it just works. Until, you know, the part that I do fault Apple for is that for some reason it just stopped working on my phone. And actually, still, I can't get it to pick up my IMAP stuff. But imagine my relief when I went in. I actually ended up having to go in through, you know, like the web interface to my email providers, you know, like the web mail client. Because actually, I think on mail.app, it just hides the notes folder as it would because it's not... You know, it's not in the business of dealing with that.
Yeah.
But then after I got in there, I said, oh, thankfully, all these notes are here. This is great. I'm going to be able to get them out. I'm going to save them and all that. But then after a little tinkering, I was able to nudge notes.app on the Mac to pick up the IMAP folder. So it's all back there. And I just can't figure out why. You know, notes on iOS is really... I don't know if you've ever used it or if you use it on a regular basis, but it doesn't have any kind of like high level concept of like what server you're connected to or anything like that. It's
right.
In the app itself. It just shows you a list of notes. It's really great from a simplified, you know, point of view, but I don't see how that reconciles with the fact that, for example, you can have multiple accounts on your phone set up to use notes, and I don't know if it's supposed to mix them all together or what. Right now I have an empty list in notes. So anyway, that problem's halfway solved at least. And I thought that was kind of funny that I was saying on the show, you were saying, I think it uses IMAP. I think it can use IMAP. I'm like, I don't know. And it turns out that's where my notes were the whole time.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you got them back.
Yeah.
It is weird. It's not, unless you kind of know about IMAP, which most people don't even know, then, you know, how would you know to look there? How would you know about the syncing? I mean, it hides maybe a little too much in some cases. I used to use notes on iOS, but I switched everything, as I mentioned before, implied last show, to Dropbox and haven't looked back. Well, actually, I switched to SimpleNote and then I switched to Dropbox. So,
you know, I have a little mixed record here, Manton, but one of the things that keeps me from wanting to store some of this stuff on something like Dropbox is like, it's like you were saying the last show, it's great that at the end of the day, the data is there and you know where to find it and you can just load it up. But I fall a little bit on the, I don't trust my, you know, some of my notes are just my pizza sauce recipe, but some of them are, you know, maybe something real confidential to me. And I'm not sure how much I trust having that stuff go out to another company's,
you know, server. Well, but hold on a second, though. They're on your IMAP server, which, I mean, your hosting provider has probably had more security exploits.
Yeah, that's true.
I hear what you're saying, though. I went through a period, not with notes. I don't care about notes that much. If all my notes were made public, yeah, it would suck, but I don't think it would be that, wouldn't be that bad. But I have thought about that a little bit as I use Dropbox more and more. I was kind of late to use it, but as I got my new MacBook Pro, fairly new, you know, several months ago, Retina MacBook Pro. When I got to that and moved to that, I decided to put everything on Dropbox, like everything that's not source code. Source code goes on, you know, wherever.
Wow. So you pay for
yes,
this premium.
Yeah, just the I think it's like it's the lowest you can pay with premium, and it's still plenty. I'm now moving all my photos to Dropbox. Their camera import is really slick, so I don't have to sync with iPhoto or anything. I can do everything import directly from the phone. So I'm moving everything there. And so I did have that period that you're talking about of, yeah, you know, are there some sensitive documents that I don't want there? And so far, I've decided that not to worry about that.
Yeah.
There may be a few things that I haven't put there. But for the most part, I'm just diving in, because the advantage for me personally, when I was moving to this new machine and just having an extra backup, and being able to just seamlessly access this stuff from different devices, kind of outweighs the sort of paranoid part. Well,
that's really interesting. I mean, the other sort of like, I guess, you know, I'm willing to put it on IMAP. Why not put it on Dropbox? The other thing is, obviously, I'm willing to put all of my stuff up on Backblaze, but
that's encrypted.
It's encrypted, right?
Yeah.
And as I understand it, Dropbox is encrypted as well, right? But they own the key. Is that the deal?
Which, so that encryption, it doesn't quite count as much. Backblaze, no. I trust. I use Backblaze too, and that I think is 100%. I mean, there's no way anyone can access it unless they have my key.
Well, that's when you get that customer support. When you get that customer support answer that says, "I've lost my password. How do I get my backup data back?" Mm-hmm. And their answer is unequivocally, "No way. We're sorry. It's actually technically impossible."
Right. Whereas Dropbox, their employees aren't supposed to. And they ran into this kind of problem a couple years ago, right? Where I don't know what, if they actually had a security problem or if it just came to light that this is how it worked, but their employees are not supposed to look at your files.
Right. I don't like that. I don't like that level of security one bit.
Right. But they technically, I mean, they probably have to get like manager approval or something, but technically it's possible like for some rogue employee at Dropbox to figure out where the master key for this stuff is and get to files. Hopefully it's very difficult.
But yeah.
Technically they should be able to do it if they,
well, that's you know, it's interesting. The way you are using Dropbox makes it so close to a full service backup. You know, I think I would really ideally like to have something like what you're describing, something between Dropbox and Backblaze. I mean, what if?
Well, I could see Dropbox offering like another pro tier where. So they encrypt stuff, but they need their servers to be able to read it so that they can do smart stuff about duplicate files. Like if I'm sharing a file with you, it doesn't actually need to put it twice on their server or something like that, right? That's their argument for not having full encrypted stuff.
That's Dropbox's argument.
Dropbox's argument, right? They can be smarter about how they sync files. And Dropbox sync, I mean, super fast. I mean, it blows anything else away, especially Backblaze, which is very slow.
Oh my God, it's a nightmare to get anything out of Backblaze.
Right. But I could see them having like this other kind of pro tier, which is like, no, really, I'm serious. I want everything encrypted. Like, I'm sorry, it's going to be more intensive for your servers. Maybe sync is not going to be as fast in some cases. It's going to have to store more data on your servers, but I'm willing to pay for that. You know, I really want this secure.
And you have the option, of course, of sort of faking that by just putting like an encrypted volume in your Dropbox folder. Like, but yeah, that's something in between would be really cool though. If I could say, hey, I'm just by you signing up for this service, everything on my Mac is not only being backed up, but available to every other Mac or phone that I use.
Right.
And not even having to have it be in the Dropbox folder, you know, just say like, oh, I think I left that in, I think that's in my applications folder back on my Mac. That's okay. That's really easy to get to because I mirror all of my, you know, mystery box stuff everywhere. Anyway.
And for other apps to be able to access it too. I mean, I think that's one of the great things. And I'm getting back, kind of circling around to your problem and, you know, and my sort of rant about the problem with iCloud and the backups, and like, you don't know how to get to this stuff. Everything is, you know, completely opaque. You don't know where this stuff is. Being able to have an API that's fairly open that multiple apps can access is great. So related to that, you said last show, there's this web interface, and I said you were like,
put down the crack pipe, check yourself into rehab. You have just imagined a parallel universe in which Apple would provide exactly the kind of open access to the files that you were dreaming of.
Well, I wouldn't say exactly.
It was, the way I said it.
It turns out that you're right. There is. Is it developer.icloud.com?
Developer.icloud.com. You have to, you know, as the URL implies, you have to be a registered developer to use it. But, you know, we actually got into this, folks, right after the last show because we were so curious about it. And I was like, okay, Manton, let's go check this out. And we should have actually recorded it because Manton's reaction was like, what? You know, it's like, this is, it's like, it was like I was taking him through the gates to the Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, you know, and it turns out that it is incredibly surprising and impressive that Apple does, you know, allow even just developers to get access directly to the file, you know, in a hierarchical structure, the files in your iCloud. But we both decided it was a little bit disappointing, right? What seemed like there was a lot of stuff missing.
Well, yeah. And I mean, and you say impressive, but it's only impressive because my expectations were so low. So I believe what it is, it's, as you said, folders and files, but I think it's only if an app on Mac or iOS is using, you know, the iCloud documents sync, whatever they call it. And so it doesn't, like the key value store stuff isn't there. The iCloud backups, which was my big complaint, that I couldn't access an individual app's backups using iCloud backup. None of that's there. So it's fairly limited.
Yeah,
when
it's
I looked
just
at
documents.
The list,
okay.
It wasn't particularly useful for me personally. And the list of apps was fairly small compared to the number of apps I use.
You would think that because this is obviously just for debugging, you know, it's not meant for users, you would think that they would go ahead and put in some kind of as far as just like a web app that shows you, you know, files, I think it would be easy enough for them to add the key value storage stuff in here. And that would be useful from a debugging point of view. Right.
Yeah. But the more you can add, the more valuable it becomes. And just, I mean, even for users, even forget about debugging, even for users being able to access this kind of stuff would be really useful. Like I said before, Dropbox, their new data store API, they do have a web interface that normal users can go and they can browse this data and see what apps are storing.
You know, Manton, I think that this developeriCloud.com actually does list core data syncing. It's just that there's no app that has ever actually successfully synced it.
There you go. Okay.
Oh, boy. Nice. That's promising so I was looking in here too. There is this app, actually this com.apple.notes folder in here. And I was like, wow, this is useless to me because it's empty and documents are empty. And then come to find out, oh, Apple wasn't actually syncing my notes. So at least not on iCloud, but, Anyway, I'm sorry that this didn't lead to, you know, you finding a magic folder full of the sync data for the apps on your iPhone, but at least it's something. It's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we are happy to have back as sponsors this week, Crashlytics. Crashlytics is the really great framework for recording and reporting crashes in your iOS apps. So that you can go back and browse them later, get really great insights into where the quality issues are with your apps. It's real easy. You go to Crashlytics.com, you sign up for a free account, download their SDK, which is a standalone app that actually does the work of opening up and dropping in the necessary components to your Xcode project. You build it, you ship it, and next thing you know, any crashes that people run into out there in the real world get reported up to Crashlytics.com. And it makes it real easy for you to become responsible for crashes in your app.
Yeah, so it's a great service. Two things I wanted to point out we haven't talked about in a while. In addition to the basic crash reporting, they also have a logging feature, which I think is really interesting because you can put logs in your app around where you might have problem areas or when errors happen. And then those logs will actually be kind of bundled in with the crash so that when you browse users' crashes, you can actually get some more information than about what your app was doing than just what the crash itself showed. So that's a great bonus. There's also something I just noticed they the so they've integrated with some other different services like bug trackers. So like if you have a crash and you want to send it kind of into your bug system so you can formally track it in addition to tracking it in Crashlytics or instead of, they have integration there. And I noticed they have some open source stuff up on GitHub, and we can link this in the show notes, but they have some examples of like, if you want to write a custom service so that from Crashlytics, you can send the crash to like your custom internal bug tracking tool or a tool that's not supported by kind of the out-of-the-box Crashlytics. Out-of-the-box, they support like Jira and Pivotal Tracker, Redmine, a couple of those, but they also have hooks where you can extend that. So really nice kind of workflow if you have kind of an existing workflow that you want to hook into the Crashlytics service. So thanks for sponsoring the show, Crashlytics. I've been using a tweet library, really happy with it, and I hope everyone can check it out. That's at www.crashlytics.com.
So Manton, I have been, I've been, one of the things that's been nice actually about my hiatus from BitSplitting, the podcast, is I have been able to spend a little more time doing my actual job, programming, supposed to be making a living. And on top of making a living, I'm also supposed to be, you know, developing my skills, my abilities as a programmer. And we've talked about this before, you know, how you and I both share this in common that like a lot of times technology from Apple, we see it at WWDC, then we're like, oh, this is so exciting, this is going to be so cool. And we're like, oh, I can't use that because, you know, I still need to support 10.6 or 10.4. And I'm in this great position now where I have committed to using 10.8 or later for, you know, a bunch of my projects basically going forward. And
great.
What fun, because it's like, oh, it just, folks, if you're not doing this, you need to do this. You need to at least find one project you can work on with like either the latest or very close to the latest stuff from Apple, because it just, it gives you that opportunity to stop saying, oh, I can't use that because I need to support this and that, or to have to like, or to have to use stuff, but by jumping through like the most like careful hoops of like testing whether the functionality is there. You know, with this stuff, I'm like, hey, I know 10.8 has this, I'm going to use it. And one of the things that I'm finally trying to get, you know, more versed in and competent with is all of the Grand Central Dispatch, lib dispatch stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you've had a chance to use much of that.
Yep. Yeah. I love it. It's great stuff. Yeah.
It's great stuff. It's that kind of technology where you not only have to learn, first you have to learn the technology is there, then you have to learn how to like technically use it. And then you have to learn how to change your entire approach to programming, which is the hard part, you know, funnily enough. A lot of people who came to the Mac or iOS from, you know, languages like JavaScript that have this kind of, you know, that support this kind of programming flow, I think they have a much easier time with it. Mm-hmm. For me, coming from like the stone age of programming where we were just like banging two rocks together and hoping that a program sparked out, it's really mind-bending to, it's simultaneously mind-bending. And then, however, when you start to see how it comes together and how it works, it's like, oh, you know what was really mind-bending was a like state machine of like callbacks and like, you know, moseying something along down this process, when now with libdispatch, NS operation queues, stuff like that, you can actually just express things in a way that makes sense and is readable. So I guess maybe mind-bending is during the learning process, but then I'm looking forward to it all being much less mind-bending than it is now.
Right, yeah. And it's still, I mean, I still don't think I'm using everything to its full extent. I mean, I've got a scattering of, you know, code in there that uses it, that uses blocks more, a lot more, but there's still a lot I could do. But I have reached the point finally where I'm not using NSThread. There was a while where, you know, I saw the WWDC sessions about all the new stuff, but I would still NSThread and like fire off this thing, and then I've got to lock something, and then I got to check this for concurrency issues. And I finally passed that point where I am using slightly newer APIs.
You're all queues all the time.
So I don't, I don't use – so are you using NS operation queues a lot, or are you using the sort of – because there's several levels of, you know,
yeah.
Well, the API, and I've never gotten into operation queues quite as much. I don't know why. There's something about the API that when I first used it, I can't remember now, but I just never got into using that level.
Isn't that funny? It seems very common that, you know, with this whole – with libdispatch in particular, it's very common for developers to, for some reason, adopt it at the lower level instead of at the higher level. And yeah. That's unlike other technology. You know, most people, you're like, oh, how do you draw, you know, an image to the screen? Well, I use NSImage. You know, most people aren't going down and using, maybe that's a bad example, actually, but a lot of people are using CG image stuff, but...
But they're not using, like, a bitmap context
or something
just to draw a simple
image. But with Dispatch, people tend to go right into the dispatch calls. I think that's a testament to how elegant and sort of integrated the dispatch calls are, you know, even though they have this ugly C style, you know, naming with like underscores and stuff, mm-hmm. They seem pretty straightforward to drop into your Objective-C code.
I think it's, in some cases, it's more readable than the higher level stuff. And I've also made a couple little macros so that the underscores don't, so I have like a little macro that does like dispatch async or whatever the one I want to do on the main thread or, you know.
Right.
Which makes it even a little more readable. But yeah, I feel like it's a little more readable. I get, maybe just because it's in line. So if you're doing something simple, you don't have to create a whole nother class. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, so I did start off like many of us, like you, I started off using just the dispatch stuff. I also think I did it in a sense because it felt like a really good way to understand what's going on at the lowest, obviously not at the lowest level possible, because, you know, that would be going into what dispatch itself does. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe I just thought it would be a good idea for me to understand this before I go to an abstraction like NS operation queue. But I did end up finding some good reasons to go with NS operation queue pretty quickly. In particular, there's some nice features with NS operation queue, like you can set the maximum concurrency for a queue.
Oh yeah.
So I had this problem in Mars Edit where I was, you know, switching something to use to use libdispatch, and it was a networking type of operation where you could have, you know, conceivably hundreds of networking operations fire off to achieve this task. Mm-hmm. To put it into concrete terms, it's like downloading thumbnail images from Flickr. Okay, so there's no call at Flickr to say, give me all the thumbnail images for this list of photos. So you have to say, give me this one, give me this one, give me this one. And putting those all at the sort of mercy of libdispatch ended up like jamming up my dispatch. Like 64 threads were fired off and they're all like jammed up. And, you know, I was talking with our friend Mike Ash about it, and he's like, well, I think you basically, you know, you used up all of the dispatch queue's threads, and now it can't even like service the thread to like, you know, basically a major deadlock. Mm-hmm. And turned out like that would be somewhat challenging to solve with pure libdispatch. But I just switched from using a dispatch queue to using an operation queue and set the maximum concurrency to 8. Mm-hmm. And then it was like just fired right along, just smooth as butter. So that's an example. I think NS operation queue also lets you reorder the priority of things, like, which could be useful. For example, so like going back to like thumbnail viewing, imagine you've got like this list of 500 Flickr photos, and you want to, as the user scrolls around, obviously you want to show them the thumbnails quickly. So you have 500 items in this queue to load when they get a chance. But as soon as they scroll halfway down the screen, maybe you want to move those items that are now in view to the top of the queue. And I think NS operation queue lets you do that. I'm assuming because like, you know, behind the scenes, they're just actually keeping it out of a real queue until, I don't know. Cause with a real dispatch queue, you put it in there, and I don't think there's any taking it out or reordering it. It's just there until it's done.
Yeah. Now that you've described that process, especially that example, I feel like an idiot for not using this, because It wasn't too long ago that I, in TweetLiber, I wrote this kind of complicated class that downloads, you know, like, you know, user profile images and other inline, you know, images people post to Twitter. And it, you know, it handles like throttling different, you know, so it doesn't do too many requests at once and caching images and all this kind of stuff. And the way you just described it, I probably could have saved a lot of time by leveraging something like this instead of creating my own way to handle that.
Well, I think there's also a problem with NS Operation Queue in particular that some of us have like this voodoo sense of it being flaky. Because it once was, you know.
Okay, maybe, yeah.
I remember, I think in the 10.6 time frame, or maybe 10.5, actually going back to Mike Ash, I remember he wrote his own like operation queue alternative because there was like some situation he discovered, I think, where it could lock up or something. So that kind of reputation sticks with a class, you know, and you think, I don't know if I want to use that. I kind of feel that way about NSURL. Connection. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have my own like independent, like, you know, right. whole networking stack that I built when I probably should switch to NSURL connection because I think the bugs are fixed.
Well, but so you've waited long enough now that NSURL connection is now deprecated. So
is it?
No, seriously, in iOS 7 and Mavericks, right? There's the new URL session stuff that I probably slightly break NDA. But yeah, I mean, so you've waited long enough that there's something even better.
that's my forte. And right when I'm like, oh, I'm finally getting into operation queues, they're going to be like, oh, now that's totally old. That's outdated.
Yeah, I think you're right though, because it's been a while, at least a couple of years, since I used NS separation directly, and I think I don't know if it was a bug or I just didn't get something about how it worked or it wasn't a good fit for the app I was working on, but for whatever reason, there was an impression in my head that it didn't work like I wanted it to, and so I haven't really looked at it again.
Yeah,
I probably should revisit it. Another app, or another framework, I guess, AF Networking, which has kind of taken over the world. I mean, it's, everybody uses it, and it's excellent. It uses NS operation heavily. And I guess when I first saw that, I was surprised, but I mean, it works really well. It's a good fit for how they've designed the framework. And I don't think it's underestimated. You know, when I said it's taking over the world, I mean, I think everyone is
it's very popular and very well regarded.
Yeah. And it's great. I use it now too. I like you kind of said, in Clipstart, I had my own little download. I had a couple different download sort of things going on. One was based on curl. One was based on, you know, probably URL NSURL connection. But in new apps, I'm just using AF Networking now.
Yeah. I think that I actually have a ticket open to myself to look at integrating AF Networking. I think it is good. That's an example with this NSURL connection and with NS Operation Queue. It's an example of where the abstraction means that Apple can completely reinvent how it behaves behind the scenes, and we benefit. And it's like that NS Operation Queue. You know, people should remember that NS Operation Queue predates libdispatch, so there wasn't even like this concept. And I think what happened is they invented lib, you know, not, I don't know if invent is the right word, but they came out with libdispatch and they're like, you know what? This would be great if it's at the AppKit level too. Oh, we already have this class that claims to do something kind of like this. And so then they can just like rejigger everything behind the scenes and it runs on top of libdispatch, and it's suddenly a completely different ballgame. It's not the same thing at all anymore. Mm-hmm. It just happens to have the same class name and fulfills the promise better of what it's supposed to do.
Right.
So, you know, concurrency is a very interesting subject. While I was kind of trying to wrap my head around this, I found some good resources. There's actually this really great new magazine called ObjectiveC.io. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's at ObjectiveC.io. It's the URL. And they have a whole issue of articles about concurrency that's really, really well-written stuff. It's like a, you know, highly edited, well-written magazine format, tech journal, basically. And that was a really good resource. And, of course, Apple's concurrency documentation is good, too. It talks about a lot of the, you know, types of ways you can use blocks and operation queues and all that. I'm really looking forward to getting Mars Edit in particular completely moved over to operation queues and dispatch and all this, because it is I don't like to talk bad about my own app, Manton, but it is a nightmare in there.
Yeah.
It is a real mess. And it's a mess, you know, with a good excuse. It's a mess that tries to tackle a hard problem, which is concurrent networking connections, and tries to tackle it in an era before libdispatch or blocks. So,
and there's something just to be said just to moving to one consistent way to do this stuff. Maybe you already have that one consistent way and it's just old, but I know in my app, you know, like I mentioned, like libcurl, this other thing, this connection, like I have,
yeah,
there's too many ways, and it was just a weird side effect to the way I built the app and the way I added services. But something to be said for just, you know, having one great way and everything using that.
Yeah, and in particular with an app like Mars Edit, where it's so heavily network based, it's sad if it's difficult to add stuff in the networking level.
You know? Exactly.
So it's like, I'm looking forward to, like, right now when I look at something and it's like, oh, there's this new WordPress feature. It would be great if we could integrate support for this new API feature at WordPress. And I'm like, oh God, I'd have to go in, you know, to the code that whose name shall not be mentioned.
Yeah.
And it's dispiriting, right? So yeah. Anything, if you, whatever app you work on, whatever the core technology of the app is, you should make it, you should find a way to make it so, you know, expanding upon that is easy. Because mm-hmm. if you can't do that, then you're just not going to be able to grow your app at the right speed. So I'm in one of those situations now where I'm looking at this like, all right, this is going to be a little painful. I'm going to have to, you know, reorganize my code and rewrite a bunch of stuff, but I should be able to come out of it. It's one of those things where you like go at a snail's pace for, you know, months or a year or years, who knows. And then when you come out the other end, though, you just like lightning, because you have, you know, facilitated all this future work to happen.
And hopefully you can do it as part of, I mean, I don't know, I'm always frustrated rewriting stuff without having any user-facing stuff to show for it. But hopefully if you, this seems like the kind of thing you could add a feature at the same time you're doing this that's related. You know, like add a networking feature that would have been difficult before and is easier now that you've rewritten stuff. And so then you have something you can be kind of excited to show users at the same time that you're doing all this sort of
You will know, Manton. You will know when I have achieved this, because there's some real subtle things that are wrong with Mars Edit. And one of the subtle things is you can't cancel any network operation.
Yeah.
So if you're like trying to post a post and your server's down or something, it's going to sit there until it times out. And it's so frustrating and it's so embarrassing. Yeah. And one day, it's this subtle little thing will happen.
A cancel button
will be there.
Well, no, Daniel has rewritten his entire app.
Mars Edit 4.0, now featuring cancel buttons. It'll be like, you think that's enough to market a major update?
That's all how you spin it. If you have a glitzy enough website and the cancel button's really shiny.
A concurrent new design, Mars Edit 4, coming soon, fall 2013. Designed in America, made in America. What do you think?
It'll probably be faster too. Always talk about how fast it is.
Oh, it'll be fast, yeah. And it won't have any of that crappy 10.6 code in it, I'll tell you that much.
I'm glad you mentioned the obc.io website, because I've only read a couple articles there, but it looks excellent. And it's just on the web, right? It's not, they don't have like a newsstand.
Yeah, I think
it feels like it's like a newsstand.
I think they're just kind of going for a kind of an elevated image. Mm-hmm. But it is, as far as I could tell, it's free. So, you know, everybody should check it out and support those guys. Tell them they're doing a great job, especially if you think they are. And
you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of a little bit, and maybe this isn't a good comparison, but the old Apple's old Develop magazine from the 90s. I mean, I don't know when it ran, but it was probably just a few years. I don't know. It kind of reminds me of that style. You know, we got an issue. We got several sort of loosely related technical articles with really good example code, diagrams. I don't know.
Yeah.
It has a great feel to it.
It's great. It's cool. Cool that they took that style of picking a kind of a topic. And so, like, you know, like I mentioned, we will link folks obviously to the magazine, but in particular to the concurrency issue, which is, you know, so they have like five articles all relating to concurrency. And I think I like that because it's like it gives sort of some purpose and, you know, some cohesion to a quote unquote issue, even though, as you said, it's, you know, not on a newsstand or anything, but it gives them some kind of like a reason to pull things together in a meaningful way. And I like that. So,
yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, this week. Good talking to you, Daniel. And we'll talk to you again next week. If anyone wants to check out our Twitter feed, it's at Corint. Same thing on app.net, at Corint. And always happy to hear what you think about the show. Feedback at corint.org over email, or leave an iTunes review in the iTunes podcast directory.
All right. Thanks, folks. Great chatting with you, Manton. And I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye.